Getting from point A to point B is easy. Getting from point A and having to take a bus between point B to all these different stops is the journey a movie maker wants to take.
This is the Action Filmmaking Decoded Podcast. A podcast dedicated to raw action analysis.
Ooh, my gosh. For fans of action cinema out there, how badass would that be?
Each week, we bring you a new action filmmaker to break down your favorite scenes.
360 off person, round kick the guy from a 360 spin.
Now, introducing your hosts, Darren Tun and Mike Messina.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to part two with Garrett Warren.
In this episode, we cover more of the in-depth breakdowns, including scenes from Logan, Avatar, and Alita Battle Angel.
So without further ado, let's get right into Logan.
Hello. You know you gotta pay for that, right? Hey, come on.
Not okay!
I dove into the Logan screenplay a little bit, and this one excerpt pretty early on really jumped out at me. I love to read, for the listeners especially, a little sort of excerpt from it.
Wait, let me guess. I'm not going to say it out loud, but is it the one where is it the one where he actually gets hurt?
Yes.
Okay, good. I put that on my stunt t-shirt. I put that on the back.
Oh, my gosh.
I took that exact excerpt out, and it's on the back of my Logan stunt t-shirt that I give out to my crew.
Wow.
Go ahead, read the excerpt. I love it, too.
That's awesome. I'm going to read. It's just going to be a couple clips from it. So if you want to look at the whole script, if you're listening here, there's a few more sentences here about it. But essentially it says, now might be a good time to talk about, quote, fights described in the next 100 or so pages. If you're on the make for a hyper-choreographed, gravity-defying, city-block-destroying CG fuckathon, this ain't your movie. Logan's about to get his ass kicked. He's older now, his abilities ain't what they were, so by all means, go ahead and worry about him. Just, what was your reaction to it? I mean, we already got a sense because you have it on your t-shirts,
that's,
but...
That's where I said I want to do the movie. When James gave me that script, I said, yes, this is my movie. I don't want to do a fucking video game. I don't want to do a fucking video game. I want to do a real movie, and this is going to be a real movie. I go, I love it.
I love how, like, I've read through plenty of scripts, and seeing something that frank was very refreshing.
I thought it was amazing. I can't tell you how I was 100% in. And it is refreshing to hear that. It is refreshing to hear we're going to do it all on camera. It is refreshing to say, Garrett, go ahead, be brutal. And I was like, you're kidding me. Really? Yes. You want to cut heads off? Cut heads off. I'm like, oh, man, thank you. It's about time. I finally found someone that understands me. And then that's it. I was brutal.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I'm sure that R rating definitely allows for that. Was there anything that I know we mentioned, or we saw rather, somewhere that some stuff got left on the previs floor? Is there anything that you really wanted to see in the movie that didn't make it all the way through?
No, I'm not giving that to you guys. The movie's perfect the way it is. You know what? Once you let your child grow up, I don't care if he's a garbage collector. I don't care if he's, you know, a famous Hollywood actor. He's the most amazing child there is, and he's perfect just the way he is. Let it go.
Gotcha.
So, yeah, so as far as, is there anything on the editing room floor that I wish I'd shown the world? There's a lot of things that we did. There's a lot of stuff that they didn't put in there, and I saw the reason why he didn't put it in there, and I think that he did a great job. You know, the man's a great filmmaker, and it's perfect the way that it is. And the stuff that was left on the editing room floor, I'm sure you're going to start seeing in some other films that are out there, too, because I've got a whole lot of stuff that I kept in my bag of tricks.
Again, like I feel like we keep coming back to this very, very zen, growth-oriented and almost ego-free mindset. Again, you know, very much can tell that this is a martial artist's perspective on things.
Exactly. It is exactly that. It's the Bruce Lee, you know. If you pay attention to the finger, you will not see the whole heaven above, you know. If you pay attention to the stuff that you didn't get to put in the movie, you're not appreciating the movie that you just created.
Absolutely. The heavenly glory, definitely,
exactly.
As he says.
Exactly.
And I know we talked a little bit about this before, but you talked about action serving the character and the story. And we also talked about it in our previous podcast, your attention to detail, as well as the emotional content and intention of the film. For instance, you were saying that it's okay if it's dirty, as long as it feels real. So I'm kind of wondering, Is this something that you always had a great attention to detail for, or did you develop this over the course of your career?
I don't know. I've been a film nerd all my life. I've loved movies all my life. So I've always had this huge, as you've heard, I can quote movie and director, and I've always had this attention to detail. However, I have to admit, the very first Avatar was one of the most mind-bending experiences I had ever gone through in my lifetime. To have, you know, Jim Cameron hammer me about every little detail and open my mind up as to the greater scheme, the ramification one punch can have, was life-changing. So I believe from 2000 on, the world became a different place for me, especially since I had gotten shot back in 2000. But after 2000 on, I looked at things in a much more visceral, brutal, detail-oriented way. And I think that going into Logan, it all culminated there. And I was able to use a lot of the emotional response that I was trying to get out of the audience with the action that we were able to create. And that was all thanks to Mangold and to the script that we had and the cast that we had. I mean, Hugh Jackman was genius in that. And that little girl was absolutely blinding. She was awesome. So yeah, I've become much more driven about detail and brutal in the last half of my life, but I was always detail-oriented, even as a child.
Laura!
Laura? Laura. No. No. Move! Go!
I'm going to jump in real quick because I know one of the best components of the film is that relationship and really just the introduction of Laura herself in her own right as a character. It's sort of a pseudo origin story for her. So talking about from a filmmaking perspective, this concept of reveals for her specifically, you have some abilities throughout the film that we're revealing about her. One that comes to mind is seeing her foot blades come out that of course Logan or Wolverine doesn't have. Is there anything unique about choreographing for the reveal of an ability like that or for a visual like that?
I was able to choreograph how the foot blade was going to come out. When Mangold brought it to us on the script page, it was kind of obtuse. It wasn't really like precise. And so I was able to say, okay, this is when the foot blade will come out like this. However, that does nothing compared to what the story had brought forth. So when you're doing a reveal, the reveal has to be something out of necessity. She was tied up. She was grabbed. Her hands were all completely useless. So you think to yourself, whoa, this girl can't use her claws now. And these guys have her. She's being taken away. And Logan is also useless. He's on the ground hurt, and he can't get up and help her either. So that's it. You guys are done. This is it. And then all of a sudden, it comes out of nowhere. No, it's not over, guys. She's got a foot claw. You know, and it's like, holy shit. There. So being able to do it with the camera was easy for me, you know, because I just put the camera in the right place. And I said, this would be great, because all of a sudden I'm going to have him look up with his eyes and go, what the, and sell it with the big eyes. And then I'm going to spin and I'm going to see her point her toe and the claw come out. And then I'm going to see it stab up and hit this guy in his chin. So that was easy for me to do. But my hat's off to Mangold. He's the one that said, okay, if we're going to reveal this, we're going to reveal it out of necessity. We're not just going to like take a drape off of a statue. We're going to make the world see it because they're going to think that, oh, all hope is lost. And then this is going to come out of nowhere. In fact, there was a movie that did this as well. Do you guys remember The Rundown?
No, I don't.
Yeah, I saw it. Yeah, it was Dwayne Johnson, right?
Yep, The Rock's in it. I was one of the whip guys in it. If you haven't seen The Rundown, you should. It's a really good movie. It really is. Peter Berg directed it. It's an excellent film. Christopher Walken's in it, and he gives a great performance. So, You guys are missing something, you know. Sean William Scott is funny in it. Anyways, at the end of it, The Rock does not want to shoot guns, does not like guns, and he's being pinned down by all these bad guys that are shooting around him. And this world is erupting, and there's just bullets going on all around him. And there's a person nearby doing a monologue in a Scottish accent of a poem, right? And it's Rage Against Death, right? And you think The Rock is just going to get destroyed now because he's going to get shot to death. He's going to get killed. And then all of a sudden, within one moment, his eyes snap open and he looks up And you can just see a trigger go off in his head. And he kicks his shotgun up into his hand. I'm sorry, I've just ruined this for you. And all of a sudden, you find out that, guess what, guys? This motherfucker is a badass son of a bitch with a gun. And that's why he doesn't like guns, because he kills well. It's that kind of reveal. That was the same kind of reveal with Laura. You know, when you see her being pulled away and all hope is lost, and her foot claws come out and she's able to gut a guy's face with her spike, you say to yourself, oh my gosh. And then she uses it to chop people up. This is brilliance, you know? So my hat's off to Mangold.
Very much like you.
And there's one other reveal scene I wanted to sort of touch upon, which is that farmhouse scene, brilliantly sequenced overall, in my opinion. So we see, in case you haven't seen Logan, then I'm spoiling this for you as well, but yeah. In case everyone hasn't seen it, we have X-24, sort of this evil younger version of Logan, this clone of Logan. We see X-24 separately, completely in a separate location from Logan at first. Then after a scene with them, we have this dirty over-the-shoulder shot by the stairs where we technically see X-24 and then legit Logan in the same shot. But then slowly you'll see X-24 and Logan really reveal themselves in the same frame as the camera's moving.
Right.
And they're both walking around each other, crossing the camera, crossing frame. And it's just this really stunning sort of feat of filmmaking to see both clearly be Hugh Jackman, one being young Hugh Jackman, one being older. Emmanuel Manny mentions that you were pretty adamant about not showing that two shot immediately. Can you explain? He talked about it a bit, but can you explain your own thought process there?
You want to draw out the suspense. You know, you don't just want to automatically get to it and have people feel the, basically the thought process is this, you know, as soon as you do the two shot and you have them face off, it's done, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in order to get there, and the whole world has seen this with countless movies, especially when it comes to The Matrix. And I got to admit, I kind of steal from them a lot, you know? And Neo is down in the subway and Agent Smith is there. The first thing you do is, you know, you first have to zone in on their faces and you have to start with a wide shot and you have to just show them head to toe, what their body is going to do. Then you have to slowly start to creep into a medium close-up and you have to see their reactions and to see how they're dealing with each other. Then you have to creep into the tight shot and you have to see that their resolution is in their mind as far as what they're going to do next. Then you have to bring them to the two shot, which is the two of them together and their final culmination of them being face to face. And so that is why you can't just go straight ahead to the two shot. It's going to not service. You've got to tell the audience what the other characters are thinking first. You get it? You have to make the audience feel each other person's journey. And if you do that, that two shot is going to resonate bigger.
Yeah, and even after that sequence that we sort of talked about, you have X-24 coming face to face with some cowboys who are confronting him about something.
Yeah.
And then you have that, you know, technically it is a delivery of violence, but what it really is a promise of what is to come really in the sequence right after that bit of the scene, which is X-24 actually going toe-to-toe with Logan for that sort of pseudo-cathartic moment in relation to that entire bit of the film.
Yeah, I actually thought that was fantastic. I love chopping that guy's head off and having it fall at the ground. I was going to get to that point real quickly. Loved the fight. I thought the fight was fantastic. Hugh was fantastic in it. I love the fact that we were just constantly, slamming him and getting him to the ground. We're going to stab these claws right into his face and then pummeling him with that car into that we took that truck and drove him right into, I forget what it's called. It's basically like this big, huge farming piece of equipment. But we drove a truck right
spikes.
Into
spikes.
Yeah. So we put a concrete block there and drove a truck right into the concrete block. So that car driving into that piece of farm equipment. So what we did was we took the farm equipment away. Right. And then what we did was, so we did a plate shot with the farm equipment. Then we got rid of it and we put a concrete block there because we didn't want, we wanted the car to just stop. You know what I mean? Like it hit, because when it hits X-24, it has to basically hit him and stop because he's also a very formidable presence. You know what I mean? Like if you hit him and keep going through him into the farm equipment, then you don't show the world that X-24 is also a roadblock. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It would have been easy just to drive the truck into the farm equipment, but it wouldn't have shown that you were hitting X-24. It would have shown that you were just hitting a piece of farm equipment. So you get rid of the farm equipment, you take a plate shot with it, you put a concrete block there. So when the truck hits it, the truck doesn't go anywhere. So it actually just crushes him into the farm equipment, but it, at the same token, it just stops, dead stops.
I definitely saw some VFX breakdowns of how we sort of digitized that double onto the, or with Hugh Jackman's face. But yeah, that's an interesting choice. Was that always part of the process when we were planning out the scene to do it like that?
Yes. Yep. It was one of the things I had pitched Mangold a long time ago. And I said, you know, any way you look at it, we're just going to do a whip pan with it. And we'll start with the car. And we'll have it drive at him and we'll whip pan. Mm. And then we'll cut. And on the whip pan, we will put the K-rails in front of the farm equipment. Mm. And we'll drive the truck right into the K-rails. And we'll have it go whoosh. And then from there, you'll put in the digital Logan. You know, we had Hugh stand in front of it and act like he was getting crushed. You know, and then we actually comped those on.
Wow. Very manly sounding stunt. I really like it.
It was amazing. And you know what? Here's a quote. This is a quote I got from Jim Cameron the other day, actually. When I was on the set, I asked him, how do you make an audience fear a villain? And he said, unpredictability and extreme consequences to a character you like. So for the reveal, looking back at the reveal, even if we talk about the reveal for like Laura with her foot claw, you know, when you have an extreme consequence to a character you like, this little girl, and to Hugh Jackman, right? You like them both, and you have this extreme consequence happening. And then you allow the reveal to happen then, it hits the audience better.
Yeah, it's like it's one of those sequences, in my opinion, where you watch through it, and it seems so logical the way all the emotional beats happen. But then when you really try to dissect it, you realize there is a lot of, there's so many different ways it could have gone, and it took someone a lot of work to really land on the exact right order of things.
Yeah, that was,
or a right order at least.
That was Mangold. My hat's off to him. He's really good at story in that sense. And I tell you, when we first started that movie, I was told Bad News Bears. Mm. Now, I'm not sure if you guys have ever seen the original Bad News Bears with Walter Matthau. He's this reluctant guy that doesn't want to be with these kids. And James Mangold said, I want this movie to be like the 1970s Bad News Bears movie. You know, I want to shoot it like that too. I want stuff to be real. Use zooms even. And I want Logan to just constantly be annoyed with this girl and hate that he's with her, just like Walter Matthau was in the Bad News Bears. And once he said that to me, I was like, I get it. This movie's going to be awesome then. Because in the end, he falls in love with her. You know, and it's a real love. Anytime someone falls in love with a child under those circumstances, because at first he hated her, and then at the end of it, he loved her. You know, you realize it's real, it's true love.
Looks like you. This is your avatar.
Just relax and let your mind go blank. It shouldn't be hard for you.
So with the first avatar, I mean, I can picture what it's like to plan out like a one-on-one fight, but there's like large scale battles in this movie. And I'm kind of just wondering how you approach some of those larger battles, especially that final battle in the first Avatar.
Man, I've got a vivid imagination. There is nobody out there that has a more vivid imagination than James Cameron. You know, that guy is genius. Mm. So he was already there to give me guidance and tell me exactly where it had to go. But for the most part, I had so many things that I wanted to show him, I wanted to do. And I had this like chip on my shoulder. And I'm like, oh man, wait till he sees what I have in store. And there's a lot of it that he liked. And there was a lot of it he was like, no, that doesn't serve the movie at all. You know, we don't need to do that. So
yeah,
when we got to doing that final battle sequence, there were so many elements that you guys can't understand. There were banshees, there were flying, you know, spaceships, there was helicopters, there's Samsons, there's oh my gosh, there's you know, Na'vi running, and there's Home Tree falling down, and there's people being tied up, and there's, you know, explosions and all sorts of stuff. And how are you going to do it? Well, here's how you do it when it comes to Avatar. The first thing you do is you shoot the whole thing on a performance capture. That's it. Mm. Done and done. You have everyone get out there and you get on a performance capture stage and you shoot your idea of this final battle. And you keep on putting all the scenes together and you create, in essence, the best previs that has ever been made in the history of mankind, right? And then you go back to it again and you say, okay, I want to add this in there. And then you go back to it again and you add even more into it. And don't forget, we had been on that movie for 5 years. So we were able to go back and back and back and back many times, you know, and constantly make that final battle even better. So
you can go in and add people and things in there, like even after you recorded the first.
Yep.
So
welcome to
Previz. Wow.
So that was our Kobayashi Maru.
Wow.
Yeah, we cheated. You know? So more important than anything, though, is that, you know, once you get all of that down pat and it looks amazing, then you go out into the live action element and you shoot all the live action pieces because you've got this great Previz that's already cut together and you're on a performance capture stage doing it. We can do anything we wanted. You're on a performance capture stage. If you want someone getting grabbed by a banshee, lifted up in the air, done. I can do it right now within 10 minutes. And then once that's all done, you have all the rough steps cut together and you have your editing team piece it all together and you have, you know, animation that's good enough. Not great, it's just good enough to show the world what it's going to look like. Then you have a general understanding of, yeah, this is how the fight should go. Or you know what? We should have this happen here. You know, we should have a guy getting grabbed out of a Samson by this beak, thrown in the air, and then redirected midway through, you know? And so I remember saying to myself, you know, when is this fight ever going to be done? That's how long we were doing.
It just sounds like whatever you guys could think up literally was possible.
That's
with,
right.
With that technology, especially.
That's right. That's right. And that's how it's so good. That's why it's so good because, you know, he didn't just shoot action. He shot all the action. Then he put it together in a story sense. And then he got rid of the action that just didn't make sense to the story and didn't, you know, push it forward. So that's why it's so good. Whereas a lot of movies, you've just got to shoot as much as you can because you're going to have to just deal with it and edit. You know what I mean?
Right. Mm-hmm. It's better to have more than less.
That's right.
Of course. Yeah. And I know you mentioned James Cameron. I'm kind of wondering what it was like to work with James Cameron and what makes him such a great director. And I know somewhere else you also mentioned that he really makes you believe in the stories that are being told. How does he do that?
Dude, first of all, the guy's way beyond the scope of what my intelligence can handle, can fathom. He knows so much that I don't know what to begin to tell you. Like, he can walk into NASA and they can try to explain to him how this magnetic field is being held in the air. And he can tell them, oh, well, that's actually the Meissner effect. And they go, what? And then he'll start telling them about, you know, the quantum physics. He knows things about quantum physics. He knows things about, you know, I mean, don't forget, guys, he designed. I'm going to say that one more time so you guys understand this. He designed his own sub that went down further than any other submersible in the history of mankind to dive lower than any man in the Mariana Trench. He designed it himself. And afterwards, from what I understand, a couple of his designs are now being used by the military. Not for bad or anything like that, but just, you know, for safety's sake inside of their submarines and their submersibles and so forth, you know? The man is also, I believe he's a part of like the board of National Geographic where, you know, he goes out and discovers societies and he like explores different tribes around the world and archaeological digs. So the man is, so how does he make you believe it? Because this man knows more than any of us do, do. And he's done so much research that he says, okay, this could happen. There is a theory here. You know how Einstein would come up with the theory of relativity and how to, go back in time and so forth. And he's the same exact person. And he says, well, there is a scientific plausible fact that could happen. And then he'll come together with that and then he'll put it into his movie and then he'll strip that away and put some badass girl in there with a gun and make her kill people. And that makes you all love it and accept it and feel like it's real. So for a lot of filmmakers, they just say, okay, well, let's just pretend that the guy comes out of this tube and, you know, he's been grown into a clone. Jim would go, bullshit, that can't happen. Now, if there is a particle accelerator, because, you know, and then he'll start going into, there's a team at MIT because of something he read in popular science, whatever it is, there's a team at MIT that have done, you know, particle acceleration. And he starts getting into it. Then he brings that in and he says, okay, so then next thing you know, he's laid scientific fact into the fiction that is trying to be, you know, created. And the next thing you know, you've got this reality-based idea that the whole world loves.
And I feel like as a director, people forget how useful it is to have extensive knowledge and experience about the world to just put into your films as well.
Yeah, he goes for the reality all the time, and he'll sit there and clear the set and just rehearse with people until he can get that reality down pat.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
True science fiction, not just like using science as an excuse for this fantasy sort of a thing. Very cool. As a physics major, for me personally, I really appreciate that.
It's true.
So next step, we'll start making some submarines and then take it from there.
It's true. You're right, man. This guy is a genius, you know? And there's times where he comes up with designs that are probably going to be, you know, used in the future. So it's funny that there's a lot of things that he came up with that will probably be used on future, you know, space flights and future things that you guys are going to see.
Crazy, crazy. And I wanted to also ask about Avatar, the wildlife specifically. There's whole sequences here that really depend on the different flora or fauna that's happening on this crazy alien planet. And for the action specifically, what was that creative process like when you're working with not just, you know, people on people, but working with different kinds of fictional animals?
Dude, let me tell you something right now. You just opened up a can of worms because he has books created on his plants. And the plants alone, he has like dissected into their actual makeup. You know, oh, this one uses chlorophyll. This one, and I'm like, nobody cares, Jim. Nobody's going to know about it. I do. And I go, okay, I get it. And I'm not even sure what they're called, but I mean, he's got these names for these plants, you know, cephalopods over here. And I can't remember some of the names, but, you know, he has created these creatures and he has based them on real birds or real creatures. And then he has amplified them up and he's amplified them up in like this pseudo prehistoric way that is futuristic now, you know? So they are creatures that could possibly exist. And you watch it and you go, wow, this is actual. These look like they could live, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that definitely comes through in the design. And then also just beat for beat in the sequences when they're being chased. Did you personally have any hand in planning any of that out?
No, I had the hand in executing it, but the chase was all Jim. I mean, let me tell you guys right now, what do you want me to say? I can't lie. That guy, he knew exactly what he wanted, you know. And on page, it says he's running and he falls and he goes down a hill and he runs around a tree. And I gave him that and he came out and he goes, that's boring. I went, what? And he goes, nobody wants to see a guy run across a field. And I go, okay. And he goes, they always have to have something in their path. He has to go over something, under something, around something, and then almost get caught. And he has to fall. And then, you know, the thing has to chomp at him and he has to get inside of something. And that thing is like biting at him and his teeth are right in front of him and he repositions to try to get him again. And while he's repositioning, that's when he does something else to get up. I'm sitting there going, okay. He goes, look, getting from point A to point B is easy. Getting from point A and having to take a bus between point B to all these different stops is the journey a movie maker wants to take. And I said, I get it.
When I found you, your very human brain was miraculously intact.
It's the loneliest feeling not to know who you are.
In time, you'll remember.
I love Alita a lot, you know, and Robert Rodriguez, what a great filmmaker. I worked with him on Sin City at first, and that's where I fell in love with him, and he's not changed. He's genius right now, and I love that he's doing Mandalorian. He is one of my favorite filmmakers out there. Mm-hmm. And I love Alita. I thought Alita was fantastic. When I was starting the first Avatar, Jim had came to me and says, what do you know about Alita Battle Angel? I go, oh, what? The anime? I go, I love it. It's fantastic. I go, are you doing Alita Battle Angel? He goes, yeah. He goes, I've written the script and I want to do it. He goes, wait till you see this motorball game. He goes, it's just going to be badass. And I was like, oh man, I want to do this. Let's do this now. He goes, wait, we'll do it eventually. And he wanted to direct it at first. It was supposed to be Jim's baby. And then he just didn't have the time. And Robert came through with a pitch saying, look, I could do it. And this is my pitch. This is how I do it. And Jim was like, yeah, that sounds amazing. Let's do it. So that's how he got Alita Battle Angel going. And they did a great job. Look, Rosa did a great job. I think she is Alita, if you ask me. I think Kristoff is a fantastic doc. Everybody was genius in that movie. There was nobody that was bad. It was so well cast. And I loved doing that fight scene in the Kansas bar. That's one of my favorite fight scenes. As a choreographer, I had so much fun doing that fight.
Maybe that'll teach you some manners.
You might mess up your hair.
Now, were you familiar with the books before jumping into the actual film?
Of course. Are you kidding me? What kid? Yeah. I hope everyone's seen it, even the animated movie.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Is there anything that sort of comes to mind for you for how to really successfully adapt something like that to a live action?
You know, I thought Robert did a really good job with it. I think that unfortunately, because we used Weta and we made Alita look so real, it became very costly. It is a big ticket item as soon as you go into that reality. And her skin looked so good.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
That's expensive, guys, you know? And unfortunately, the world didn't flock to the movie as much as, you know, it made its money back, but it wasn't the huge success that they wanted, that the studio wanted, you know? But is there a way to do it in the future? You know, I guess that if you can just get an actress to play her specifically and not have to be the digital representation, I just feel like you're going to lose those eyes. She has those eyes that look like a star child. You know what a star child is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So star children is a folklore, I believe. But, you know, my fiance, her name is Madison. She's got these big eyes too, right? And I've always said to her, I go, you look like a star child, you know? And Alita has those big eyes. And I don't know if you can really find, there's just no way, because my girl, my fiance, her eyes still aren't as big as Alita's in the comic books. And I think that that's what makes her such a great character in that movie, those eyes, because her eyes are what sets her apart from anyone else. She is a completely different breed of character. And so I don't know if you're going to be able to shoot that practical without doing a digital character.
Right.
It's definitely one of the first things that comes across when you see even just the trailer. When you're seeing that performance, definitely.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, the motorball sequence, that was a very digital sequence. So you're not going to get around that. Even nowadays, if you're going to do it, you're just going to have to bite the bullet and put it in there no matter what. I don't know why. I did a movie called Real Steel a long time ago, and it was a really good movie. Mm-hmm. Not many people saw it in the movie theaters, though. And I don't know if it was because of timing, where it was out against or whatnot. And I think that Alita might have been up against something, too, and it just took the audience away from it. But I think Alita Battle Angel is a great film. I think it's something that I can watch over and over again. And that, to me, is a true litmus paper as far as whether a film is good.
Mm-hmm. Such an endearing character, too. And I know that Panzerkunst sort of style in fighting, it was really interesting to see it translated, again, into that live-action format. Is it possible to talk about any of the influences that went into the choreography there? I saw some maybe like Taekwondo kicks, some Aikido sort of redirecting takedowns and things like that.
Kinda, not really. I didn't really like, I didn't steal a lot from Aikido, but yes, there was Taekwondo kicks in there. Yes, there was Muay Thai. I used a lot of Muay Thai. You know, like Tony Jaa's, when Tony Jaa's warming up in the first Ong Bak and he's doing his forms. You know, like they do with the elbows and the knees and so forth. I use that for her as well. I also stole a lot from, you know, Wushu. And then there's another style called Kalari Payet.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure you guys don't know about that.
No, I don't.
Kalari Payet is the first martial art of all martial arts.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yep. Created in India by Bodhidharma.
Mm.
And so it's a very weird kind of a martial arts. So between that and also between what the Spetsnaz use, you know, the Russian military martial arts that they use. And I forget what the style is, but you know, we tried to steal a little bit. The redirects came from the Russian Spetsnaz martial arts.
Is that Sistema, or is that something else?
Sistema, yes.
Sistema, okay.
So those redirects that you saw in there, I took those from Sistema.
Okay, awesome.
And then there was some weird kind of sprawling aerial moves that she would do. Not wushu in its sense, like the one wushu move where she jumps in the air and spins around and does like a Taekwondo scissor kick. You know, that's Taekwondo and that's wushu. And some of her moves where she like blocks the sword like wushu and spins it around to block the other person, you know, that's wushu. But there is a couple of moves where she grabs a guy's arm and spins around and flips. And I kind of stole that from Kalari Payet.
I got to go into a little rabbit hole and check some of that stuff out.
Yeah, Kalari Payet looks weird. And you say to yourself, I don't understand how this could be someone's martial arts, you know, and how they still practice it. At the same token, if you think about when it was created and how people were fighting back then, you realize, oh, okay, maybe this was a martial arts back then. There's definitely some really weird Sistema videos out there, but there's some amazing ones with this old guy that's the founder of Sistema, and he's doing some really crazy stuff that just doesn't look like it's real. Like people are just – it's that made up martial arts kind of crap. You know what I mean? But then there's some stuff. there's some stuff where there's this one guy, and I'm telling you right now, I don't know how he doesn't kill the people he's working with, because people throw punches and he's just like slips them to the side and hammers a guy in the face. And it's like, man, he looks like he will kill you. And that's where we were trying to get, you know, that same kind of vibe. So we stole some highlights. We really didn't take the whole martial art itself.
Okay. Yeah. And like, you know, of course, seeing in MMA, you have all these different styles coming together, but seeing that same sort of concept of mixing those different styles in that film perspective, you know, you have things that you wouldn't see coming together in an MMA or a contest setting like that with full contact. It's always interesting to see everything come together.
There was a lot that went into it. There really was. And I love that you guys are asking about it, because, you know, it was a big deal. And back on like Divergent, I tried to create another martial arts as well with this whole peekaboo style. And I think it got lost. It was supposed to be, I stole the idea from George Foreman with the hand high and hand low. And that's how I actually fought when I used to fight in Taekwondo and in the ring. I used to fight with one hand high and one hand low. And I was trying to keep that peekaboo style and create it into this Divergent kind of fighting posture. And a lot of times it looked too rigid and it just didn't follow suit. But it was there, and it was supposed to be something that was spectacular. And I still stand by it. I think that I still use that front hand low, down low, and my backhand high up on my face when I fight.
Mm, and again, seeing all that come together in that bar fight sequence, I know you mentioned it before. That's, you know, something special about bar fight sequences.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%.
There are at least two instances where you see Alita sort of dropping down and throwing a right hand to the body, which to me makes sense for a character that's shorter than a lot of the people she's fighting. And then from a larger perspective, between that, looking at things like Real Steel or Transformers, I see a lot of works here where you have a smaller character going up against larger characters and size disparity coming into play. Is that something that you keep in mind when you're going through these things?
It is. It's a very big deal for me. In fact, I used to look at a lot of like videos of guys fighting tall guys, especially like the very first UFC. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys ever saw the very first UFC fight. Yeah, with that small guy against that big tall guy. You'll see that he did a lot of those things. And that's where we kind of like stole a lot of those ideas.
Interesting. Yeah, those early, especially fights in Japan too, there's a lot of weird size matchups.
Yeah. And let me tell you, you know, a lot of the times those guys would hit and move around, and they would do it while they're hitting. You know, they would hit and slide to the side while they were doing it. Down low to the body, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Makes sense.
Hero. All I see are junkyard punks, assorted cyber trash, and a bunch of drunken motorball burnouts too slow to play the game.
And speaking of the bar fight, I guess, how are your bartending skills?
Yeah,
now?
Thanks. And, guys, you guys crack me up.
Your character, was he standing by the bar to like protect it? I was kind of wondering.
I was supposed to be, yes. Thanks. I love that you guys saw that. I love that you guys caught that. Yes. You're very funny. I mean, I wasn't supposed to play the bartender. You know, I was showing him all these guys, and he's like, no, he doesn't look like a bartender. No. There's no one. Right? He looks at me and goes, you look like you should be the bartender at this bar. And I was like, okay, all right, I'll do it.
Yeah, take it as a compliment, right?
Yep.
And I also saw towards the beginning of the scene in the performance capture behind the scenes footage, you see Rosa sort of grabbing her opponent's neck and I guess sort of like a collar tie sort of a grip.
Yep.
And then, you know, bashing their head into the table. But then you look at the final cut and it's Alita grabbing Zapan's like an exposed robot windpipe and then grabbing him and pulling him down by that. Was that always the plan to have it like that in the final cut? Or is there anything that changes between the performance capture and then the animated polished final?
No, you guys nailed it actually, because, you know, when we shot it, you're right. She slips it and puts her hand behind his neck and slams him into the thing. And that's what we always thought. The Weta guys did that as far as putting it into the exposed. We didn't know that existed.
That's very interesting to me. I'd love to see how much creative input they have there in terms of changing, even in those little ways, just the grips and things like that of the choreography itself.
Yeah, absolutely.
The entire film was underrated, I think, in terms of how many people have actually seen it.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, I thought so too.
You know, of course, you had for the Mortal Kombat Legacy series, definitely one that's near and dear to my heart. I know that it was one of the episodes you had was for season two, another bar fight sequence, which is awesome. And then apparently you have season three, which is not released yet. So we were wondering, first of all, that must be a frustrating situation. But we're also wondering, as a creator, for you personally, do you derive most of your drive, your satisfaction from the process of creating, or how much is it from releasing and then seeing audience reactions to it and seeing what sort of emotion you've elicited in other people?
I do derive more from the process of creating. I love and I live for the response from an audience. I think it's fantastic to see someone get it. I think that's one of the most amazing moments ever. But the process of creating, it's the journey. It's like they tell you, you know, it's not so much winning the medal. Mm. Once you win the medal, it's over, guys. You know, it's the journey that took me to get there. That's the most fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, another very martial arts answer, I feel like.
It is. Well, you know, raised by martial arts. That's why.
Yes, I appreciate that. And then, Darren, do you have the final question here to close us out?
Yeah. Thank you so much, Garrett, for coming on the podcast with us. My final question for you is, I know you sort of make your kids sit down and watch certain films, but I was wondering, for the Garrett Warren Film School, what are three movies that would be taught there?
Ooh, okay, good. I like this one. Well, number one, True Romance. I mean, anything by Tony Scott, absolutely, but True Romance is number one on my list, okay? Number two, Blue Velvet. Blue Velvet will expand your mind and all sorts of, you know, things around it. It's one of the most pure genius movies that are out there. And then number three, it's going to be a hard one because there's a number of them out there. It's like, do I go with either Man on Fire or do I go with, I love Blade Runner as well, but Blade Runner is not as good as Man on Fire. And that's a Ridley Scott film. Or Gladiator. Do I go with Gladiator? Gladiator is another great film, or Black Hawk Down. I mean, it's a tie for all of those.
Black Hawk Down.
Yeah, Black Hawk Down is genius as well. I think that I'd probably put someone into that. Oh, you know what? I shouldn't say that. I'm going to kick all those to the curb. The Shining.
Shining.
That has to be Kubrick. You need a Kubrick movie in there, no matter what. You need a Tony Scott. You need a Stanley Kubrick. And by all means, man, you cannot deny how genius those two, and David Lynch, one of the most amazing directors of all time. So if you ask me, you got to go with those three films.
That's interesting that you went with a horror Kubrick pick. And then David Lynch, who is sort of like maybe art house horror, or, you know, I'm a big Twin Peaks fan as well.
Oh, so
that's
good.
Interesting picks.
But listen, and when those people see, Blue Velvet, they're going to see why. It's crazy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I can't wait. Again, thank you so much for jumping on the show with us today. Is there anything that the audience should be looking out for in terms of work coming from you?
Oh, you know what? I jumped onto this film 4 years ago, so I haven't been doing anything. That's unfortunate.
Okay.
You know, what I'm going to do is, you know, I've shot while I was out here in Wellington. ProGrade Digital gave me a card. Before I get off, the website I was telling you guys about is called Shot Deck. Shot Deck.
Shot Deck.
ShotDeck.com. Awesome. All right.
We'll add it to it.
Yeah. So basically, while I was here in Wellington, I bought one of the new Canon R5s, and I wanted to test the 8K RAW and the 120 frames per second, 4K. So I've been shooting a couple of things that are just going to go up on my Instagram, my Facebook page, and it's just going to be a little trip inside my mind. When I drove by certain areas, I saw things, and I thought to myself, oh, I'd love to see this happen there. So it's called It's a Mad, Mad World. And it's going to be a little trip inside of my crazy kind of twisted mind. And hopefully you guys are going to see it and get to see, what I do on my days off. I light some people on fire. And
sounds great.
Yeah, I do some fighting and all sorts of stuff, all because we just were bored.
And can you plug in the people to your Instagram?
Yes, absolutely. My Instagram is Garrett X Warren, all one word, Garrett X Warren.
Awesome.
If you liked that, please consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/actionfilmmaking and leaving a review on Apple Podcasts. Stay up to date on the show by visiting our website, actiondecoded.com, and by following us on Instagram at actionfilmmakingpodcast.